Welcome to the Daily Dive Weekend Edition. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and every week I explore the top stories making waves in the news and some that are just plain interesting. I'll connect you with the journalists and the people who know the story and bring you news without the noise so you can make an informed decision. You can catch a new episode of the Daily Dive every Monday through Friday, and it's ready when you wake up. On the Weekend Edition, I'll be bringing you some of the best stories from the week. This week, we heard some promising news from drug companies as they told lawmakers that they're projecting a major increase in vaccine deliveries that will result in 140 million more doses over the next 5 weeks. So while we are ramping up the distribution of the vaccines, many have asked, why can't we just make these doses any faster? Much of the answer in that lies into the very specialized process and raw materials that go into making them. For more on this, we'll speak to Isaac Arnsdorf, reporter at ProPublica.
I mean, there are a couple of important things to remember that were helpful to me in learning when I was reporting on this. One is that we heard a lot last year about this idea of quote unquote at-risk manufacturing, which, you know, didn't mean anything about risk just in terms of financial risk, right? And that meant that the companies were going to start making these vaccines even before they finished the trials to know that they were safe and effective, and that was going to give them a head start. But what I learned is that that didn't mean that they could kind of just like flip a switch and start cranking them out, because actually what that gave them a head start on was basically inventing the manufacturing process. There had never been an mRNA vaccine before, which is the type of vaccine that Moderna and Pfizer have created. And so in addition to needing to invent this vaccine, they needed to invent this whole supply chain to manufacture them by the millions. And that had just never been done before. And so they were going from ingredients that had basically been sold by the kilogram, and now they were trying to buy them up by the metric ton. So that's a 1,000-fold increase. And the other thing that I found helpful to think about this is that dealing with vaccines, they're biologics. Some of these ingredients are living things. So it's almost more like agriculture. It's more like growing plants than it is like just stamping out shoes or iPhones or whatever. And that makes it certainly science, but there's also a little bit of art to it and kind of learning the process of how to get the best results. And sometimes if there's a little bit of contamination, it can spoil a whole batch. So that's why even as they're expanding the production, it's not totally smooth and there's continues to be some uncertainty about the amount of vaccine that's coming out from week to week.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that very specialized supply chain and what goes on in there. You know, these vaccines right now, they encase the mRNA in little fat globules. That's how it's delivered into your body and so it can go into the cells. So everything from that process is very specialized, and there's so many different aspects to all of this that makes it very, very complicated. So like you mentioned, for them to ramp it up out of nothing, and they had to create this process. So can you tell me a little bit more about this supply chain?
The bottom line is there are just not that many companies out there that can do this. And there are not that many facilities, and there are not that many pieces of equipment, and there are not that many companies that make the equipment. So every link in that chain is sort of a limiting factor, and it all has to move together or else you get bottlenecks. And if you free up one bottleneck, then it just creates a bottleneck somewhere else. That's why it's the whole chain that has to move in this, you know, very carefully calibrated, coordinated way. So the fat bubbles that you mentioned, which are kind of the delivery vehicle for the RNA, these come ultimately from petroleum or from plant oils, and then they have to get injected with the mRNA strand. And all of these ingredients, this is another really important critical piece, is all of these ingredients have to be the highest quality, the highest sterility, because these are products that are going to be ultimately, you know, injected into human arms. And so while there might be, you know, other suppliers that are fine for animal products or consumer products, for a medical product like this, they have to be absolutely sure that they're getting the highest quality for safety reasons.
Aside from the supply chains, then, you know, I mentioned the Defense Production Act. You know, why can't we just pop up a brand new facility to help make all this stuff?
So this was a question that we posed to Dr. Fauci, and I mean, he had an interesting answer, which was sort of like, well, you could. And there actually, there are cases where the Army Corps of Engineers is helping to supervise construction to expand capacity at some of these facilities. But, you know, with this idea of basically building a new factory, by the time that you got it up and running and did all the inspections and, you know, made sure that it was safe and everything was up to the specifications, it would take about 3 to 4 months. And the reality is, in 3 to 4 months at the current trajectory, there's going to be enough doses for all eligible American adults. So it doesn't gain you anything by doing that. And that's not really what the Defense Production Act can help us with. What it can help us with is when those bottlenecks pop up, you can kind of do a little surge there and alleviate that problem. And the way it works basically is it just is the government telling the suppliers that they have to fulfill the order before they supply anyone else. So it's kind of like a prioritization. And that's how the Defense Production Act is useful, but it's not a panacea. The way that Dr. Fauci put it is, you know, it facilitates what you're trying to do, but it doesn't create something out of nothing.
We've seen the rollout be very slow. We are ramping up. We're getting pledges from Pfizer and Moderna for more supply. We're hoping to see other vaccines come online too, Johnson & Johnson, maybe Novavax. So it's starting to get up there, but you know, the production delays and everything can always pose a hamper to the whole thing. So we'll have to keep watching out for all of that. Isaac Arnsdorf, reporter at ProPublica, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This week, we also learned a little bit more from scientists with the World Health Organization who are exploring the origins of COVID-19. They've already ruled out the possibility that the virus leaked from a lab, and instead, they're focusing on when the jump might have been made from animals to humans. And in their search, investigators say that ferret badgers and rabbits, which were sold at the Wuhan market in China, could have played a big role in the spread. For more on what we're learning from the WHO investigation into COVID-19, we'll speak to Drew Hinshaw, reporter at The Wall Street Journal.
They're focusing on these animals that were present in the market, you know, their carcasses. There were a couple carcasses of ferret badgers found in the freezer at this market, and they tested negative, but we know that the animal is capable of carrying this virus. And likewise, there were rabbits present there. What we know about this virus that we didn't know, say, a year ago, is what animals it spreads through, like mink. For example, we've learned a lot. You know, hundreds of animals have been studied for their susceptibility to COVID-19 and to the virus that causes COVID-19. And right now, they're narrowing down that list and focusing on, well, which animals were potentially present at this market or other markets that could have been the vector.
And the market there in question is such a huge bit of this thing. There actually, you wrote another article recently, too, that we're also learning that COVID-19 might have been spreading around China even before the major outbreaks in December of 2019. So it had probably already been floating around a little bit, but the markets are so important because this is where they think that the outbreak happened at large, where mass quantities of people really started becoming infected.
Yeah, this is the first place they know it was spreading. So it's sort of natural to start at this market. And there's the question of the market is sort of one of the big riddles. Was this a place where it jumped into human beings? You know, was there some dead or live animal there that was carrying this virus and it went into humans at the market? Or, as is very probable, was this one of the first super spreading events? You know, people are at a market, it's not well ventilated, a lot of humidity in the air, they're talking over each other. It's the kind of place where this virus spreads very easily.
Now, we know the scientists are out there trying to get as much information as possible, but there has been a little bit of tension between the U.S. and China, things with sharing all of the data that they might have. China has said that the virus probably originated outside of their country. So everybody's kind of throwing blame back and forth. But this also makes it more difficult for the scientists themselves who are out there trying to get to the root of it. It makes it more difficult for them.
There's a few things on that. One, this trip happened more than a year later. And there's just a lot of information that's erased with time. They have nearly 100 people who are potential COVID cases that predate, you know, the confirmation of the virus. And we don't know if they had COVID because a year has gone by. It's very hard to test people for antibodies a year later and know whether that information is useful. You know, the U.S. wanted them to probe this lab theory. Well, the team, they can only send the experts that China invited. And there was no political ability to have this lab forensically tested. That was off the table from the beginning. I mean, politics hang over everything that this team is doing. The nature of the WHO is they can only do what they're invited to do.
And on that front too, you know, getting samples, looking at all this stuff so much later on, even when, you know, news started coming out about the markets, right away, a lot of the vendors there started cleaning things up, you know, throwing things away.
Right, that's
so
right.
It was just hard to get all the evidence of the initial spots.
The market was cleaned very, very early on, which, you know, it's understandable. There's an outbreak here. You know, you can understand it from one point of view, but a lot of evidence was lost. And that was a year ago. You know, just there's only so much we can find out when a year goes by. You know, they're going to learn some things. They're going to learn a lot about which animals are susceptible to this virus. You know, hopefully we'll find a similar virus dwelling in bats, or maybe something that's very, very similar to SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. But in terms of tracking, like, who was the first person to get this? The other problem is a lot of cases are mild and asymptomatic. Like,
right.
Anybody. I mean, if you had flu-like symptoms anywhere in central China last year, it's a very big group of people. It's very hard to narrow that down and figure out who was patient number one.
So back to these animals, these ferret badgers and rabbits, why are we honing in on them? You know, I know there's has to do things with the supply chains of these animals getting into the country as well. So why do we return to these two animals right now?
Well, these two animals do too. They provide a pathway for how this virus could have gotten into this city and spread. We know these animals can contract this disease, and we know they can be infected with this virus and they can spread it. And we know they were at this market. So there's something there. There's something to investigate, at least. It's at least worthy of being investigated further. And right now, there's a lot of avenues that the WHO has to look into without discounting any one idea. And this one's pretty promising.
And as I mentioned before, there's some new evidence that says that COVID-19 was spreading in China before these first confirmed cases. What are we seeing on that front? I know that it has to do a lot of genetic sequencing that we've been doing with the virus.
They do this thing called the most recent common ancestor. And you have basically two types of COVID-19, the virus sort of splits, the genetic sequencing of the virus splits. I'm trying to describe this in the most layperson's terms possible here. But, you know, early January, December, you see some genetic differences in the virus that people have. I'm talking 2019, December 2019, you see some differences. The cluster at the market, it's all pretty much the identical virus. But there's other group of people who have the virus is genetically different in slight ways. And when you look at the rate at which this virus mutates, it's like one or two mutations a month, you start looking back, well, when did this virus split into these two branches? And that takes you anywhere between late September to late November, with kind of like November, maybe late October, being the rough estimate of when this virus first began spreading.
I mean, there's still a lot to find out, and I know these scientists are trying to put together as much information as possible, so I'm sure we'll be hearing more from them soon. Drew Hinshaw, senior reporter at the Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, too.
This week, we also heard testimony from security officials that were in charge during the assault on the Capitol on January 6th. They were testifying before Congress and offered their accounts of how things went south. There was concerns of optics and a mess of conflicting orders that led to hours-long delays in mobilizing the National Guard. This week, we also learned that Capitol Police is keeping its security posture high in response to new intelligence that says some extremists who participated in the January 6th insurrection have plans to attack the building during the State of the Union. For more on the Capitol Hill security failures, we'll speak to Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico.
Even the people that were there on Tuesday were disagreeing with each other. And that's why you're seeing members of Congress say, okay, we've got to hear from some other people coming up. Right. But, you know, there's sort of two things that I would say that they heard about at this hearing. One is they were saying that the Pentagon, to the Department of Defense, was slow to send the National Guard to help them out. So we're going to hear senators now want to hear from the Pentagon about what happened. So that's the number one thing they sort of agree on. And the second is that they were not aware of the intelligence that had been gathered to show that there would be some kind of strike on the Capitol. So what they're saying is that they knew there would be protests and that there could be problems in the city, but they're saying that they didn't have the information to know that people planned to come to the Capitol.
Let's continue on there for a little bit, because it's just hard to believe that there wasn't such a heightened assessment of what was going on there. I mean, we were seeing media reports for a couple weeks before that, highlighting a lot of these extremist groups that might be potentially there. We're just hearing so much about it. And it's just hard to believe that they were not going to be prepared for something. I guess you mentioned it. Maybe they thought it was going to happen other places and not the capital. But just to not be ready for that is pretty striking. And I guess there was something made about an FBI report that was sent the day before. It just didn't make it all the way up to Stephen Sund.
So remember, of the four people that testified, three of them were dealt with, and I say in the past because they've all since left, only with the Capitol. So one was with the District of Columbia, but the other three just deal with the Capitol building. And so what they're saying is, well, look, we had heard, of course, that there were things going to happen in the city, but not to the Capitol itself. You mentioned a report. There was an FBI report or a report from an FBI field office in Norfolk, Virginia, saying that there was some kind of social media thread that was warning that there was going to be some kind of problem, looming war, they called it, at the Capitol building. But what we heard from them at the testimony is that it never came up to the level that the Capitol police chief and the sergeant at arms of the House and Senate knew that that was going to happen or that that was a threat. So it did go to lower level places, but it did not reach the level of the top people so that they would know that.
And then a little more on the delays in getting the National Guard there. Stephen Sund, as I mentioned, he's the former Capitol Police chief there. He said that he made a call to one of the sergeant at arms from either the House or the Senate. I forget who exactly. I'm sorry. But he made a call to them saying, hey, you know, we need the National Guard out here. He said he made the call at 1:09 p.m. They said they never got a formal request until after 2 p.m. You know, so there's a big discrepancy into when this plea to get the National Guard came in.
Yeah, that was really confusing. And you heard some senators saying, well, look, can you check your phone records? Obviously, our phones now tell us the exact time we made a call or receive a call. So that was confusing. But I think there was somewhat of a consensus that officials did call the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, and ask for the National Guard, for the National Guard to be deployed, and that they had heard that for optics, for reasons of optics, right, that they weren't sure if they should send armed troops to the front of the Capitol. They were afraid of that, how that was going to look. That's why you saw senators say, we need to get some people from the Department of Defense here to see if they really said that or how much of the delay. Basically, what we heard in the testimony Tuesday was that there was a couple hours of delay. And so what these officials were telling the Department of Defense is, look, our police can't handle it. They're already under attack. We can't fight these people off. We do need someone, and we don't need to worry about optics. So there's going to be a disconnect there, because I'm sure the Pentagon will come and say there was no delay. This has been a source of a conflict since the very beginning. You saw President Trump, Vice President Pence, all talking about the National Guard and who was responsible for sending them and why there was delay. So I think there's going to continue to be that problem.
And so what's next on all of this? I know we're going to hear more testimony. Senator Roy Blunt is questioning, you know, if the current structure of the way they operate their works, either on a daily basis or in emergency situations. Stephen Sund just paints this picture of them not being ready for this at all. He said no civilian force has ever trained or is prepared to handle a big insurrectionist mob like this. So where do we go from here? What kind of reforms are they going to try to work for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's been 6 weeks since this, and it's sort of remarkable that this is a first major hearing going into this. So the Congress is just beginning to look at this. You're going to see a variety of other hearings coming forward. I mentioned that they want to hear from Department of Defense officials. They want to follow up on telephone conversations. You're also going to see later this week that the House Appropriations Committee is going to hear testimony from the acting Capitol Police Chief. So obviously the Capitol Police Chief, who was the chief at the time, has left. This is going to be the person that has temporarily replaced him, to talk about sort of going forward. I think we're going to see some other hearings as well. We'll probably hear about the damage to the building and how much that costs taxpayers and what they need to do to fix all that up. And I think basically this is the beginning of a series of hearings on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, they even want to look into the roles that Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell played in all of this. There's going to be a lot of finger pointing still yet to come to as well through all
right.
of it. So we'll have to wait and see how these hearings turn out. Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to join us on social media at Daily Dive Pod on Twitter and Daily Dive Podcast on Facebook. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow us on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and this is the Daily Dive Weekend Edition.